There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast. And Stephen, do we have to talk about Europe? Shall we talk about Europe first?
Are we not talking about Europe later on in the podcast with our super secret special guest?
That will probably be revealed to people when they've clicked on the link. Yes, okay, that's a good point. Then we will keep people waiting for the excitement that is Europe to come. Let's do leadership, first of all. So who knows what will have happened by the time that you've listened to this, but we've had an extraordinary day in the office today. I mean, the Tory party really do show Labour how to backstab, don't they? We had this extraordinary situation where nominations are due to close at 12. Boris Johnson had got a very nice hotel venue booked for his campaign launch. Then Michael Gove came out without, we think now, even texting Boris first to let him know, to say that actually he thought about it and Johnson was a rubbish leader. He could do much better and he would be running. I mean, I think this is very last minute because Theresa May had got a lovely library set and she announced her policies and took questions from journalists. That was all scheduled very thoroughly. Boris Johnson had again booked this hotel, but Michael Gove hasn't done a launch event, indicating that really was a last minute decision.
Yes. And I think, well, the interesting thing is clearly in some ways it wasn't, because the MPs who were backing Boris Johnson, who you looked at and went, Liz Truss? Boris? Really? Almost, you know, seconds after he announced, were like, no, actually, I'm
40 of them immediately went.
So there clearly was some ringing round, and you assume he wouldn't do it if he didn't think he had a shot to get in the top two. I mean, as one minister who is now backing Theresa May actually said to me a while ago, you know, it's like getting a ticket to the lottery, and once you're in the top two, it's, you know, no one knows who will win.
That's not how the lottery works at all.
It is weird how this is the problem with the fact that no journalist is up from home. Sometimes you realise something which sounded profound to you.
Yeah. Is total balls.
Actually just an analogy which doesn't work. So I'm just going to
retract. Yeah. Let's go through the candidates then, okay? So Michael Gove will be familiar to our listeners from his time as a kind of Bolshevik in the Department of Education, deciding he wanted to fight the blob, also known as teachers and the teaching unions.
Looking back, actually should have been... I mean, I'm not saying that I was...
Are you going to endorse Michael Gove? Because that is not going to go down well.
Oh, no, but no, I mean, the thing is, there are two perspectives on Michael Gove, right? There's the perspective of me as someone who has to live in this country, and I'm troubled by the fact that he has been a fairly dysfunctional presence at education and justice in terms of how he actually runs the department. So there are big question marks about his ability to actually run Downing Street. Before you get into any policy questions, there is literally, yeah, the lights turning on. Mm-hmm. And we forget that, so yeah, people talk about him being a great reformer at education. In 2010, academies had A, cross-party support, B, more importantly, people in the country liked them. In 2016, neither of those things are true.
It's
the
very
public
true.
Doesn't like them, and they don't have cross-party support. So every time apparently it is now a podcastly tradition that I slag off The Spectator every week. But
don't do it, because people... I thought what happened on the podcast stayed on the podcast, but then someone copied Fraser Nelson into a tweet, and I thought, the jig's up, they're going to hear it, they're going to find out.
Yeah, okay, you're not allowed to actually tweet Fraser Nelson when we criticise The Spectator. That's not cool, guys. But, you know, whenever they go on about what a great reformer he is, he literally took a reform that was already going on, which was improving education standards, which had cross-party support, turned it into one which, to be honest, is no longer improving education standards because of the changes the Conservatives have made to it, has wrecked the DfE's ability to run itself as a department, and people and politicians dislike. I mean, that is not success.
But isn't he a great... I mean, he's a great campaigner in the sense that he's a great polariser, right? So in terms of firing up a base, he's brilliant because he gives everybody a very sharply defined enemy that, you know, I don't think he's a great moderate figure, a great reacher out. But if you wanted to be, you know, he's got Govites in the way that there are not Mayites.
Yeah, I mean, I think so the other perspective that I come at is as, from a corporate self-interest perspective, if Michael Gove, wow, it has been a long day, becomes Prime Minister, that will be brilliant news for the New Statesman because we will have a recognisable hate figure that we can put on the cover and I can use to illustrate every story about the Conservative Party I write on the website.
Do you know what I think is another problem, though?
At least 4 years?
Is that Dominic Cummings, who was one of the architects of Vote Leave, formerly of No to AV and of the North East referendum campaign, I went and watched his performance in front of the Treasury Select Committee, where Andrew Tyrie, who's not one of, you know, nature's ragers, looked like he could have cheerfully reached across the desk and throttled him. He is presumably going to be involved in this campaign in one way or another, or certainly in a Gove premiership. It'd be very hard to see how he wouldn't be involved. Although he claimed on Twitter that he was not getting involved in any leadership bids. I think, you know, he was an enormously...
I'm old enough to remember when he wasn't getting involved in Vote Leave.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, and when he wasn't really an outrider for Michael Gove, when he was sort of having a good slag off of Cameron on Twitter saying he was a hollow man. Yeah. But, you know, from my point of view, that feels like somebody who I feel has been a... Actually, I don't think it's overstating it to say a poisonous influence on British politics in the last 3 months. Somebody who signed off leaflets that looked as though they were official NHS leaflets for Vote Leave, somebody who put a lie on the side of a bus about money that we were going to get from the NHS, somebody who authorised a leaflet that implied that Iraq and Syria were joining the European Union, is now going to be presumably bringing that fact-free, emotion-led, manipulative style of politics to a leadership campaign in the Tory party.
I mean, I think... So the one thing is dispiritingly, the fact that approach has now got a 3-for-3 win record. I mean, I think that is going to be the shape of every campaign from the political right in this country for the considerable future, or at least until the left finds a way of defeating it. And depressingly, I can't.
Yeah, what is that? I mean, you know, populism is popular. That's
yeah, and also it's like it's the don't think of an elephant campaign, isn't it? Every time you say, "Oh, actually,
Turkey isn't going to join the EU."
Turkey isn't going to join the EU. People are like, what did you say something about Turkey and the EU? Yeah, it's a big problem anyway.
So because we need to, rather than slag off Michael Gove, which you know is fun for all the family, but let's quickly talk about those other candidates then, just for people who may not be so familiar with some of the other people on the ticket. Most people will be familiar with Theresa May, who I think is an interesting one for left-wingers about how you might feel about Theresa May, because she has done things that I think are illiberal. And her policies on immigration certainly are very stridently right-wing. However, yeah.
I must say, I have enjoyed all of the visa weddings I have gone to when couples... Yeah, lots, all of whom are very much in love, but many of whom would have preferred to get married with perhaps more expense than they were able to afford at that time in their lives, etc., etc. So, you know, Theresa May is responsible for a lot of great nights I've had over the last 5 years, so I've got to thank her.
Well, that's lovely. I know it's really shallow, but I really like her dress sense. I'm not allowed to say that. I like it a lot more than I like Michael Gove, Stephen Crabbe's dress sense, because that is just a man in a suit.
I also, the one thing you have to say is she has consistently been a great voice against stop and search and the behaviour of the Police Federation and the various police forces in the United Kingdom. So that is a...
She was very strong in Hillsborough as well. I think this is the thing, is that she has not been afraid to confront, yeah, as you say, malpractice within the police, which for a Home Secretary, particularly for a Tory Home Secretary, is not classically something that one would expect.
I mean, in some ways it is a bit like being asked which communicable diseases... I would like to be infected with.
And you're like, oh, chlamydia, because it's bad, but I feel like it responds to antibiotics. Syphilis is a lot more...
Yeah, the thing is, I think then she probably is the chlamydia, if this is the analogy we've decided to run with, of the candidates. Not least because the test that I keep coming back to, because the thing which... I mean, so the political things which keep me awake at night are, one, climate change, obviously, and two, if we had another bout of financial disaster similar to what we had 2007 to 2008, when you basically have to, where the one good thing you can say about George W. Bush's presidency is he decided to throw out all of the ideology and just to rescue large financial institutions. Michael Gove would not do that. He would, you know, he'd deliver a stirring speech about mercantilism and Britain's island history and then let a bank fail. Boris Johnson's vanity would not allow him.
He'd wait for it to be on Sunday night so he could put it in his Telegram column. I'll bail out the, you know, Lehman Brothers. Can I? We'll have to wait until Sunday night.
Whereas, yeah, I do at least
she would be
trust
unpopular,
Theresa May to go, actually. Yeah, so I mean, there was a moment in 2007, I think, when the head of RBS phoned Alice Darling and went, "I'm really sorry, Chancellor. I know we said we thought we had enough money to get to the end of the month thanks to the first injection, but actually we don't." And there was a 24-hour period when we did come perilously close to the end of money. I know some of our listeners think the end of money would be a prelude to a more left-wing scenario. I have never bought that thesis. I think it would have been the prelude to a much more right-wing scenario. And so, yeah, for me, I think it probably does have to be Theresa May, although the other candidates are...
Are you going to come out as a secret Liam Fox backer at
this point? I'd forgotten Liam Fox.
I know, there's always one you forget. So Liam Fox, or as I think John Elledge insists on calling us, disgraced former cabinet minister Liam Fox, is best memorable for being extremely socially conservative and having taken his best man on trips with him.
Yeah, I think the thing you've got to kind of see it as is there are basically two conservative leadership contests. There's the Gove v May one, which is basically a contest to become leader of the Conservative Party. And then there's what you might see as the kind of third place playoff, the race for position between Stephen Crabb, Andrea Leadsom, and Liam Fox. Liam Fox is obviously... disgraced former cabinet minister, sacked for reasons which were slightly strange, because it's one of those things where, I think it's one of those things, if he'd been sleeping with this guy who was not being paid by the taxpayer but was going on government junkets, I think everyone would have understood it. But
like when David Law said, "Look, I didn't want to say that I was sharing a mortgage with someone because I didn't want everyone to know it was my partner."
Yeah.
And everyone kind of went, "Oh, okay, so you have to go away and for a bit, but actually, I can understand."
We kind of understand this.
But, but I think for the sake of our libel lawyers, we probably should clarify that there is no suggestion whatsoever that anything sexual was happening between Liam Fox and Adam Werety.
Yeah, which I think kind of in some ways made it more surreal, because I still haven't really worked out what was going on there.
I know, I've got friends who I really like, but if I were a government minister, I can't think I would take any of them to like Sri Lanka with me.
Indeed. But he's basically running in order to be able to come back as a cabinet minister, because he will at some point, he hopes, be able to definitively help or hinder someone by lending them his support base, and it's a show of strength effectively. Andrea Leadsom
I clashed with Andrea Leadsom several times on Tuesday's Women's Hour, which if you're a fan of podcasts, you can probably go and find that on podcasts as well. She was the only Leave supporter in a discussion, which was me, Alice Thompson of the Times, Seema Malhotra and Sarah Wollaston. So I think she was slightly outnumbered. I interrupted at one point because she said, "The fundamentals of our economy are sound. We're the fifth biggest economy in the world." And I said, "I think we're now the sixth biggest economy in the world." So we were all being hateful about Boris Johnson. She was very defensive for someone who'd won. I think that was the thing that kind of came across. It was like, "But you guys, your side won, you know, this is okay. So yeah, you can't continue to play the underdog when you've just achieved a million vote historic victory."
Yeah. But so she's effectively running again for a serious position. And then Stephen Crabb is running, kind of to establish himself as the preeminent nice one, as
but
it were.
He wants to be kind of Ken presumably Clark, David the... Cameron in 2005, right? He wants to be the kind of clean skin candidate.
I mean, so that's the hope. That is his best, I'd say the best case scenario for Stephen Crabb is that he is the one who can say, "I'm not a figure from the past." Weirdly, there is a fairly large caucus within the Conservative Party that really doesn't want to talk about Europe non-stop for the next... I'm not saying that
them.
That is like... Yeah,
I feel their pain.
Yeah, I can only report the crazy things that people say to me. The fact that they are crazy doesn't change the fact that is what... There is a caucus of Conservative MPs out there who hope that they can yeah, obviously they understand it will be a big thing, but they don't want more civil wars over...
Guys, we've had 30 years. Maybe we could just put this, you know, when we finally left, maybe we could just put this to bed.
Yeah, I mean...
They joked.
You can see the attraction, even if it doesn't actually make...
My question on Stephen Crabb is, he voted against gay marriage. He accepted funding for his office from a gay cure group. Mm-hmm. Is the issue of gay marriage now so done and dusted, we've got it, it's banked, that will not be a big feature of the campaign?
It's a really interesting question. My instinct, it's not. I think he will have to come up with some kind of explanation. I mean, this is also someone
it's
who's
too late
backed...
for him to go on Pride. Unfortunately, he could have put a pair of hot pants on and been out last weekend, yeah. But he's missed his chance.
He's also backed conversion therapy in the past, so there are barriers, to put it mildly, between him and kind of carving out that niche as the nice one. The interesting thing is, one of his closest political allies and friends is Ruth Davidson, who obviously is gay and is getting married very soon. And my instinct is, as crass as this sounds, they will do the "some of my best political friends are."
Do you think he'll go to the wedding and just be like one of those photo ops where he's just there kind of going like, hey guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think... Because the interesting thing is, I mean, so Nicky Morgan, of course, voted against equal marriage, but she was able to kind of...
Well, she tacked back on that very quickly when she became Women and Equalities Minister and said, you know, I've... But then I guess...
She did have the advantage, though, that I'm not defending this because I don't think it's okay. You know, there are plenty of Labour MPs who voted for civil partnerships with immensely socially conservative electorates. Sadiq Khan, of course, had death threats for his incredibly pro-equality voting record. But with Nicky Morgan, it was very much, since she's in a marginal where... The swing demographic in that bit of Loughborough is very much third-generation socially conservative immigrants who don't trust the Conservative Party on some issues, but they've come into affluence, they've moved out of Leicester, and so that, for her, was why it felt politically...
Plus, she is
broad.
Quite Christian, isn't she?
Yeah,
genuinely,
she's... I mean, like,
Stephen
Crabb is also one of that kind of circle of godders in the... Because, I mean... At some point, I will do a boring long read about God and the parliamentary parties.
I like the promise of a boring long read. You don't want to overshoot and accidentally make it interesting.
If you've got a lower expectation. But it is really interesting, I mean, partly because...
Well, I think the Ian Duncan Smith kind of caucus as well in the party is very heavily influenced by faith.
And in the press as well. A lot of his biggest supporters in the press, his cheerleaders in the kind of... columnist class are kind of godders, although they like to keep... I obviously don't have a problem with those. Some of my best mothers are...
Fathers are...
Of course, church
clergy. Yeah, I know, so that's the thing. So we've neatly leaped out of being accused of being anti-religious there. Well, that's enough Tories. Let's quickly glance at Labour, although we are in danger of again being outdated on this. Angela Regal, who was supposed to launch her counter-leadership bid at 3 p.m, has now delayed that, I think in the hope that Jeremy Corbyn would shuffle off quietly into the night himself. He issued another statement this afternoon saying he is not shuffling off. He'd already kind of got... I have to say, if he were going to stand down, he would have not put himself through the horror that was Labour's anti-Semitism inquiry announcement. I mean, Anisha Kanian went along to that and said it was an incredibly unpleasant atmosphere. A Jewish Labour MP ended up leaving after being shouted at. It was not hands around the rainbow bridge over troubled water type stuff at all.
The slightly bleak thing at the moment is it is very difficult to see a positive outcome, because when you are, as the Labour Party is, effectively two parties bound together by first past the post, what keeps you together is goodwill, right? You sort of have to have a sense of... And the problem is, Labour has never been a particularly democratic party. You don't forget it had its undemocratic electoral college for a very long time. It has never been, and this is kind of the two ends of the problem, there is neither respect for the 40% of people who did not vote for Jeremy Corbyn, or the however many it is who have doubts now, or the MPs who didn't, but there also is not respect for the democratic mandate he got in a fair election. It's very difficult to continue on as one entity, whatever happens. My instinct is that there are sort of two scenarios. Either he will crush whoever he faces in the ballot, although my impression from talking to members is that his numbers are shakier than they perhaps were, but I don't think there is a candidate available who has the qualities necessary to defeat him. At that point, you would imagine the kind of right and centre-left of the party would split off and form some kind of new party.
I just don't understand how he can go on without... I mean, you've seen the list as well of all the shadow cabinet positions, and you know the fact that they've had two education secretaries, shadow education secretaries, within 48 hours. I mean, that's difficult. That won't be such an issue over the summer when Parliament's in recess. But when the Tories have got a new leader in September, that becomes incredibly difficult to sustain.
The thing is put bluntly, he cannot run an opposition with that few number of supporters. There are people on the loyalist side talking about ways they could potentially sew things back together after a leadership election, but that feels optimistic. On the other hand, the rebels' best hope is that they can secure a ruling that he would need to collect 50 nominations like the challenger would, at which point he would be unable to do so. And
I mean, I can see the point of, if you are loyal to Corbyn, of thinking, well, actually, we know we have to hang on because this is, you know, what we've been elected to do by our members. This is what they wanted from us. They wanted renationalisation, you know, they wanted anti-austerity. These are all the things they wanted. And also in the sure and certain knowledge that things, particularly now they've become so acrimonious, a new leader from the soft left would have to crush that faction in the way that Blair... Oh, you know, or during the 80s that Militant was crushed. It would have to be, as you say, you can't cohabit like that anymore, can you?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big difference is that, of course, Militant was an organised party within a party which had a standing brief to destroy the Labour Party in a bid to accelerate the...
downfall of capitalism and the bringing in of socialist utopia.
Yeah, so it's slightly different... in that there could never have been cohabitation in that situation. But crucially, the trust has gone, and it's hard to see how they...
But there's no way that Angela Eagle, should she stand again, should she win, is going to reach out a massive olive branch. She's going to keep John McDonnell in her shadow cabinet. I just think that time is now kind of slightly past.
Yeah, I think the moment which we may look back as decisive in the last days of the Labour Party is so it's what kind of happened is there were two sets of organised coups. There was the no confidence motion organised by effectively Blairites who were expecting to retire at the next election anyway. There was the Brownite coup from within the cabinet, which kind of kicked off with Hilary Benn and was being coordinated by Tom Watson. But I think the moment at which an amicable outcome became impossible was the bit in which the soft left decided, oh, we've tried, but it's not going to work. Because I think there were politicians who were probably capable
you
of
mean
winning.
And we've tried working with Corbyn, the sort of Chris Bryant make it work faction.
Yeah, kind of. But I think, say, like, yeah, if Lisa Nandy had stayed in the, was still in the shadow cabinet, then you could see a situation in which she combines a lot of the economics. She doesn't have the foreign policy. Because I think basically the unity position on Labour and foreign policy is basically not to have one. There are lots of people who are very bruised by the disastrous war in Iraq. There are other people who are very bruised by the disastrous failure of the West to find a peaceful solution to the civil war in Syria. And so basically the unity position is to be someone who's not that interested in foreign policy and doesn't really do abroad. And then there are lots of politicians who could have done that. The problem is what happened when the soft left quit is that sort of... I think it's difficult now for
there's
someone
no glue.
Like
there's no
Lisa
bridging
Nandy or Owen Smith or Kate Green to have that role. And I think they could have done so, and that could have been a healing mechanism. So yeah, it's not great.
Well, there we go. That's politics right now. You know, by tomorrow, dragons will rule the earth, so all of this will be out of date. But for the moment, let's say goodbye.
Oh. Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman, Seriously.
If you secretly care more about comics than Jeremy Corbyn, this is the podcast for you.
You can find all our episodes at newstatesman.com/SRSLY.
Right, and now we are joined by our super secret special guest, our regular columnist and contributing editor.
That's the one.
Laurie Penny, to discuss
Brexit. Brexit, Stephen. Don't leave them in suspense. It might be something more exciting.
Brexit. Look, if we had all been as passionate about Europe and as excited about it beforehand, then we would still have left, but you would be as upset as I am. Seeing as everyone else is already pretty upset, I really don't recommend being as invested as I had become by the end of it all.
Okay, so what we've done is we had a put a call out for a Q&A. So this is kind of going to work like a very extended You Ask Us. And because I've got a lot of questions, I'm not looking at you, Laurie, here, really, I will be honest with you. I'm going to need very short answers.
Okay. Short answers, I can do that.
You can do that. I've lived the dream. Okay, Stephen, I'm going to start with you. What is Schultz/Juncker's endgame with talks with Sturgeon? So Martin Schulz and Jean-Claude Juncker have been talking to Nicola Sturgeon about Scotland possibly having a different relationship to Westminster with the EU.
So it's twofold. Firstly, the SNP has, for a very long time, taken its diplomatic relationship with Europe very, very seriously. They have what... It's not called an embassy, but effectively their MEPs have set up something which, if you didn't know, then if you'd landed from another planet, you'd go, like, oh, this is a Scottish embassy, right? They've put in the work. Then basically, because Cameron has never been a particularly serious European, since 2007, there hasn't been that level of effort from the British government into maintaining those relationships. So it's partly about doing a favour to some mates, but it's also about trying to bounce Britain into working out when it's actually going to start thinking about leaving so that they can stop having their market uncertainty and get back to their problems as opposed to us instrumentalizing our whatever.
Well, let's pick that up briefly. Apart from my Laurie and my eyebrows went up, I think, because we're like, how would aliens know what an embassy was? But anyway, let's put that aside. So Ask 50 has become the subject of much debate. This is by... isn't it an amendment to the Maastricht Treaty rather than being part of the Treaty of Rome or the Lisbon Treaty? Mm. Anyway, so this is the formal statement of giving notice that, like, bye lads, see you later, thanks for all the fish. And Cameron said on Friday morning that he wasn't going to do it immediately, having previously said that he would, really. That was a signal he was giving out. He would leave it to the new Prime Minister to do. The problem is, right, that if we trigger it, we lose a lot of our negotiating power. It starts a two-year countdown to us leaving. So the theory is that they want to sew up something beforehand, particularly as I see it, the last noises that were coming out of Brussels were saying, you will, as soon as you trigger that, you will try and negotiate for your deal. But in the meantime, you will only get what's called the WTO option, the World Trade Organization option, which is a very harsh, restrictive, high tariff, difficult bargain to strike. So that's Article 50. Laurie. I'm not going to ask you about UK agriculture. I want to ask you about Regrexit. Do you think that it is a good policy for Labour to pursue a second referendum to try and say people were lied to, people are unhappy with this result?
Well, the question really seems to boil down to whether or not we want riots now or riots later. I mean, it looks like it might be both. We might get the two-for-one deal. But it's a really, really tough question because on the one hand, yes, a lot of people are regretting their vote. No, we have no way of telling quite how many without another referendum. But on the other hand, despite the catastrophe that's come as a result of this referendum already, ignoring it and pushing it through, pushing against it in Parliament would be a real poke in the eye to any semblance or pretense at democracy we still have. And a lot of people would feel like they've been ignored, which they had, and it would open a Pandora's box of resentment and rage among the population of Britain if that hasn't been opened already.
But there would be that butterfly that was on the Spectator cover at the end that would float up at the end.
Of possibly the pound picking back up and us being able to all run away to Berlin legally.
Yeah, well, I want to ask you about this because I think it's probably fair to say on a spectrum of leftiness, there's Stephen, as we all know, is a Blair. I know you're not a Blair, right? I'm taunting you. There's no such thing as a Blair, right? Like, there's no such thing as ghosts anymore. And then probably I guess I'm soft left. I guess I see myself very much as the Angela Eagle of the NS office. And then you're more up for kind of Corbynism than we are. But where were you on the European Union?
Oh, I was pro-Remain. Absolutely. Just because it was the best of two not necessarily great options, and I wasn't taken in for a minute by the kind of fantasy that some people on the left had, which was, oh, you know, if we get out of the EU now, we're going to be able to renationalise everything and a people's revolution will take place. This seems to be, and I hate to go into intra-left squabbles, but this seems it seems to be a very brochureist view, which is this whole idea of, well, we need things to get a lot worse before they'll get better. We need, you know, the total collapse of British society, and then, comrades, then we will have our people's revolution. Unfortunately, that recipe includes a lot of people hurting, a lot of people dying, and it's not something I'm ever going to sign up for. And in the meantime, that total collapse of society necessarily includes people, usually women, doing a lot of fill-in work to keep everybody held together for as long as they can. And that's already what we're seeing.
Yeah, I have to say, what I was just talking to Jeremy Bowen, who's currently in Iraq, who said, you know, he's writing something for us soon. And he was saying, you know, talking about a catastrophe. Well, I'm in Fallujah where there's dead bodies all over the place. And I was thinking back to, it's one in one of those weird things where something doesn't quite feel that it happened for me. When the Belgian terror attacks happened, I was in Uganda. And I kind of thought, actually, I don't know if people really know what they're asking for when they say, you know, this is going to be great. Like, we need to smash everything down so we can build it back up again. Actually, living in a country with a non-functioning state is really not that much fun, guys.
And also, I mean, if step one of your plan for a more left-wing society is then Michael Gove becomes prime minister, I mean, unless step two is really, really metal, then I'm just not. That is not. It's a really good observation, because I think about it and I think, yeah, I don't know a single female Lexiter. It is just it is also like a certain type of book. It's just like, yeah, but I reckon in a riot you could probably survive.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's quite a middle class view. I don't know, I'll get in trouble for saying that, but I feel, in the same way that I felt a lot of the Leave side said, you know, we don't mind this big economic shock because we'll have sovereignty. And it's like, a big economic shock for you is your, you know, £2 million house is worth £1.9 million for a bit, right?
Yeah.
And you don't have a mortgage to pay off. It's not, I don't like ever this argument, you've just got to make things really bad for people because in the long term you'll get something better out of it. Because the better out of it often doesn't turn up. And when it does, when things get better, they tend to get better much faster for the people at the top again,
yes,
right?
I think it's nonsense, and it's dangerous nonsense. And one of the things about being on the hard left or the far left is you have to, you know, grow up after a few years and understand that if you're, you know, if you're proposal for a future society or your roadmap includes total social destruction, it's maybe worth thinking it through a bit more. You know, there's I am for a road to change which includes fewer people dying.
But just think how many telly bookings you could have got out of this, Laurie.
I'm on the NS podcast now.
No, well, it's the media appearance. All they're all dying to make. But seriously, I mean, this is one of the things I think is absolutely fascinating, is that the broadcasters had a real problem with trying to get enough women on, because there were very few women involved in the Leave campaign. And actually, the way that they ended up, because they wanted to put women on TV, they ended up making it look like there were more women involved in it than there were. I think the number of ethnic minorities that were involved in the entire campaign was pitiful, frankly. Like, it did feel like a very exclusionary conversation. Stephen, is the call by the Greens, Liberals, to create a pro-EU alliance with the SNP credible? And how much will it rely on the remains of Labour? Oh, it's a pun, but also a sad pun.
I mean, so I think I know I said I'd do short answers, and I'm going to keep this as short as possible. So I think the thing is, I see the temptation of it, right, in that it allows the Labour Party, whatever Labour Party emerges from their meltdown, to basically maximise the bit of the electorate which is most, it allows it to build out from its current core, ethnic minorities, young graduates, in middle class election to intellectuals who are concerned about poverty, and it potentially gives a bridge between that group of people and people who do not necessarily agree with the redistributive stuff but are angry about the EU. The difficulty is if it doesn't work, it is a very high stakes gamble, because if it doesn't work, Labour's turned around to the other half of its traditional core and gone, yeah, we don't care about how you just voted. It's a bit like
But what does it? What form does it take? This is the question, I think, is that, okay, so you've got a progressive alliance that all agrees on one issue, but realistically, in order to get the numbers, you don't just need Greens and Lib Dems, you need the SNP as well. Yeah. And at that point, what happens the first time that you have a bill that is disadvantageous to Scotland at the expense of England? That's not going to hold together. I just don't see how you can create anything like a working block.
But the difficulty is, and the Brexit vote has, exactly as Laurie said, put us in this decision where it's at this juncture where the decisions are riots now, riots later. But yeah, because basically either you're turning around to 17 million people and going, sorry, wrong answer, or you're going to make a lot of people a lot poorer. Mm-hmm. Both of which are fairly good starting points to a far-right reaction. Like
the same thing with the immigration thing, right? Yeah. Either you're going to say, we're going to keep free movement, and then a lot of people say, well, that's not what I voted for, or you're going to really crack down on immigration. You're going to have to have that accompanied by a lot of rhetoric about how, you know, you become really cracking down on immigrants. Plus, again, we're making people poorer, and there will still be black and brown people in the country for people to blame if that's what they, you know, if that's what they've been, if that's who they've been told to blame. Oh, right, okay. Here's one for you, Laurie. I'm going to hold you responsible as a representative of all the UK media. Why do all UK media, including the supposed left-leaning ones, hate Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, I'm not sure everyone hates Jeremy Corbyn. The Socialist Worker loves him.
Morning Star
loves him. Many blogs love him, The Canary. But I'm not sure. There does seem to have been, from the start, a real push against Corbyn. I mean, I think, obviously, the Vice documentary, which I saw and was quite impressed by the levelness of, despite the fact that they caught somebody on camera saying mean things about George, which I was upset about.
It's okay, George can handle himself. We've previously covered this.
I think I do agree with the assessment that there seems to have been a campaign against Corbyn from the start, just that unwillingness to accept that this is what the Labour electorate had decided. I have no idea why he's so unpopular with the press. Maybe because he demonstrates that fact. Maybe he's not playing the game as well as other people.
This is the thing I find interesting, though, is that why would the press love him when he hates the press, right? If you're the Daily Mail, the Telegraph, he's not giving you anything. He doesn't want to give you anything. He hates you. He thinks you're the enemy. I just don't know why you would think that that would then not be reciprocated in a way. I think it's been a really interesting question for people in left-wing media. I mean, what we have tried to do is give him a fair hearing, mm-hmm. whilst acknowledging he wasn't the candidate that we would have chosen or backed. I think the funny thing about Vice is, I think that having talked to people, I know you've talked to people who've said the same thing, actually that Vice documentary did the most to undermine support for him among people that are any of people who are kind of Corbyn regretters, and they're not by all means you know a lot. That's not a majority view among people who voted for him, but there are definitely a core people who've said that. What they say to me is it's about competence. Actually, they still really agree with him. They still want a leader who can do that. They just have lost faith in his ability to be that person. And the Vice documentary was what did that.
And I also think, because I think the thing is so one MP has a good phrase, you know, journalism is a manufacturing industry, you just need to open a factory. And there are lots of people who I'm not going to name because I'm worried some of them might, you know, track me down. But there are lots of journalists who we can see effectively just repeat what they're told by random politicians. And they haven't even put the energy into turning those people. A good friend of mine on the left of the party, but who's younger than this current generation that's in charge, thinks, and part of the problem is that if you came into politics, Corbyn was elected in the worst year for the left of the Labour Party, when they started to retreat. He thinks that they just expect to lose, which very rapidly becomes self-fulfilling. They don't have that confidence than some of the 2015 intake who came in a year which was actually very good for the Labour left in terms of its representation in Parliament, and then they won a leadership election in a landslide. And, you know, people like Clive Lewis, Cat Smith, Lou Hay, they are much more up for talking to the media and playing game, partly because, from their experience, they're on a run of form where they've kept winning. The problem is, I think, a lot of people around Corbyn have just kind of got used to being defeated.
But I also think that I don't know if this is a particular, maybe a mirror image thing happens on the right and I just don't know about it, but they feel much more let down when they don't feel they're getting the support that they feel they deserve from the left-wing media. I think it's really interesting when you talk to people around them and they are much more worried about what The Guardian, the BBC, the New Statesman are saying than they are about The Sun and the Daily Mail, which, not to be rude about us and The Guardian, but, you know, we are connoisseurs publications, shall we put it like that? Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that's, you know, that's a kind of fascinating one. Okay, enough.
Well, it hurts more on that. It hurts more when your own side are gunning for you. If the right or whoever you see as your enemy is giving you a pasting, you expect that. But then if your own side is also not shoring you up, I mean, you see this on like an intimate personal level.
I was
going
to say, this is like the story of all of your and my Twitter beef.
Yes, exactly.
For many years.
Exactly.
Is that, you know, you feel you have to answer to people on your own side in a way that you don't if somebody's kind of making crude sexist joke. Well, that's just, they're not, you know, that's not my people. Stephen, do you think Andrea Leadsom has a chance of being Prime Minister ahead of the better known and more experienced May and Gove?
I'm worried it's going to be possible. No. I just don't think she's got the numbers to get into that final two. I also think the problem with Boris's exit is there are going to be a lot of people who wanted a meal ticket to the top. And they will fall behind one of the big two. And that makes it much harder for any of the newbies to break through. And to be honest, to be a newbie, you don't have to have gone to Eton to become Conservative leader, but you do have to have gone to Eton to become Conservative leader if you're not already a big name. Because the advantage Cameron had is he had 40, basically the Eton MPs kept him in the race in the first couple of ballots, which meant then he had time to be get heard of by people who didn't know him from his school. Oh God, that sentence is so depressing.
Yes. Oh my goodness.
Oh God, Britain in 2016. I mean, the one of the good things about the destruction of Boris Johnson, and
it there is are
the,
many.
Yeah, I mean, there are many, but it means that there was a brief moment when people were talking up the idea that Yvette Cooper might become Labour leader again, which raised the terrifying possibility of not just two party leaders from Oxford, but two party leaders from the same Oxford College, which I just would. I mean,
which one's that?
From Balliol.
Is that your college?
But I'm not running the country.
I'm just saying it might turn out that it was the source of all evil and we should have, you know, burnt it down some time ago.
It's entirely possible. But I mean, I just think occasionally when I do like international radio or whatever, you sometimes reflect on the fact and you're just like, oh, we sound like a basket case. We sound like a ridiculous country.
Oh, well, I always think that.
We are a ridiculous country.
Yeah.
When, you know, that great phrase by Robin Cook about House of Lords reform saying we are the only country, us and Lesotho are the only countries that elect hereditary chieftains to their legislature. And it's really true. In Lesotho, they have an upper chamber that is made up of hereditary chieftains. And so do we. We have random old aristocrats who we kind of come in and have an election by 8 members to get into the House of Lords. And then they can vote on our laws. It's mad. It's just mad.
I believe you're the only other country that has hereditary, clerics as part of the upper house is Iran.
Well done, Britain.
Hooray,
turn the rules to waves. Laurie, in the very long term, do you think we will get back into the EU?
I hope so, but I don't think anybody has any idea of what the medium term will hold, never mind the very, very long term. It's really too soon for predictions of that kind. I wouldn't want to say anything with any confidence. It's whatever the EU looks like in the next 20 years is going to be a question of whether or not we want to join, even if we can. But because surely everybody in Europe hates us right now.
And I they think have we're a, reasonable.
They have yeah, reasons reason. To do that.
But I also feel like there might be a tighter Europe that comes out of it. Because, you know, one big non-Euro country is exited. Denmark is, which also doesn't use the Euro, is not kind of moving towards the kind of United States of Europe model either. It's very unhappy about that. You know, Norway's got its special deal. I wonder if the Euro countries will get tighter and then, you know, there will be a sort of second, you know, a proper
second
level of a
membership.
Sort of associate membership. I don't know. Stephen, what do you think? Do you think we'll go back?
I think.
Do you think we'll ever leave? There's another question. There's lots of people keep going, will it actually ever happen?
The thing is, I think, yeah, what might happen actually is You can see a situation in which, I mean, the slightly unnerving thing is we're now basically going to have a situation which after however many million people have voted, 15,000 or however many Tory members it is now, but it's not very many, will basically decide which version of Brexit of the many versions that vote leave kind of through everyone because they kind of like, oh, here's a menu. And then basically, well, after millions of people have picked from, have said, oh, we quite like this menu, yeah, a handful of people go, actually,
I want the fish.
We wanted the fish. And you can see how what might happen is a situation in which, you know, maybe Labour unearths a charismatic politician who can unite the whole of the Labour Party, who is pro a second referendum. This person having the ability to feed the 5,000 with only five loads and fish is obviously optional.
King Arthur coming back to save, King basically.
Arthur, I mean, basically, a mythical politician who there's been little evidence of there being in any part of the PLP could arise. And then they could... Yeah, because I think the moment for a second referendum is when we know what the out deal looks like. Because it will be so far from what we were promised. And I think a referendum where you go, stay in or have this deal, is not, I think, ignoring... the notice to quit. It's going, look, here's what you've asked us to do, here's what we've got, are you happy with it, yes, no? And then hopefully, and this is very optimistic, but hopefully, even if we then picked out, the economic consequences might not be quite as politically destructive because people would have seen the option as opposed to this situation in which, basically...
We don't know what we voted for.
We have no idea what Leave looks like.
Collage. I'm going to ask myself a question now. So, Helen, did Jeremy Corbyn let the Labour Party down by not campaigning hard enough for Remain? I think this is something that keeps kind of coming up. This is actually the kind of core of the disagreement between Corbyn's supporters and the PLP. The thing that I think, and I'm pretty sure you've said this, Steve, on social media, is that Corbyn's Euroscepticism is not a secret. Like this, I went back and I read, we sent Barbara Speed to interview him when he first stood, before we even knew whether or not he got on the ballot, actually. And he talked about the fact that he wouldn't automatically support Remain, depending, he would be very much depending on what Cameron got. Now, if that's your honest position, Cameron got chop all, right? So really, you should campaign for out. And he expressed that as part of a wider scepticism with NATO, which we don't even talk about, his long-standing history of worries about American power. So really, there was an overwhelming mandate from the membership, if you want to say it that, for a Leave campaign from the very top of Labour. And actually, anyone expressing surprise about Corbyn's unenthusiasm for Remain doesn't seem to have really taken a good hard look at him before they elected him. So that's that one dealt with, I think. We're going to talk about Regrexit, but I think that we kind of covered that, really, didn't we? About the idea that Lib Dems are now offering to campaign on a going back in. David Lammy has campaigned for a second referendum. Are there any other MPs, Stephen?
Daniel Zeichner, the Labour MP for Cambridge. My guess is MPs for university towns will, regardless of where their own parties end up, will probably decide that that's what they're going to be for. Because, I mean, it is bad, bad news for Britain's universities. The electorates in basically every university town, so not somewhere like Hull where you have a city and then you actually do have a university, but where the university is the main employer, those are basically all, you know, landslides for Remain. A lot of people who are facing uncertain job futures, it just feels to me unlikely that you could get elected out of Oxford, Cambridge, Bristol, whichever seat it was, which encompasses Warwick, without having a fairly robust position on this being a disaster. I mean, it's just like no one's ever going to get elected out of a mining town on a position that Thatcherism was great.
Laurie, I wanted just to finish. I wanted to ask you, from your position on the left, what do you want from the Labour Party now? Like, given we are where we are with so many MPs having declared a lack of confidence in Jeremy Corbyn.
I would like them to get their act together. You know, I was just reading the news again this morning and thinking, it reminds me of, you know, when your friend is having a panic attack over a decision, right? And you get twisted with, is it going to be this one? Is it going to be this? What are we going to do? And, you know, there's total meltdown. And at the end of the day, no decision is always worse than one of two not very good decisions. I just want them to make a decision and stick to it and all get behind it. If they all want to get behind Corbyn, fantastic. If they want to find someone else and all get behind that person, I would be almost as happy. You know, I think either of those would be much better options than what we've got now, which is Labour eating itself and seemingly not really paying much attention to what's going on outside its own internal meltdown. That's how the Labour Party is letting the country down right now.
Here's something I wanted to ask Owen Jones, and I didn't get around to this morning. Also, I thought, you know, firing questions at him on Twitter is probably not a kind thing to do to him right now. If the Labour Party split into a Corbyn-led faction and a more centrist one...
Oh, God.
I'm going to say Podemos and...
Passock's in Greece and is very much kind of a dead parrot, but it's certainly looking poorly. It's the POSE, an SPD and a Die Linke.
Yeah, so which one do you end up voting for?
Oh, God. I have no idea, Helen.
Do you go back to the Lib Dems?
Are there any Lib Dems left? I thought there were like four of them.
Well, they had a big surge in membership as a result of, as you say, having one position that is, you know, that everybody in their party believes in.
Tim Farron turns out to be a fantastic spokesperson for all of this.
Well, I think he has the advantage of having a minority party. Maybe this is where politics is going, is that you can't hold together these big electoral coalitions with people, you know, with wildly diverging opinions on things that are now very salient. And the Lib Dems are in the luxurious position of not having to hold together that kind of big coalition.
I just feel like a vote for either one of those notional sides would be supporting, kind of enabling the left in its ongoing split. God, you know, if our reaction to everything is to split, it's like a deconstructing Terminator. Terminators, when they're under massive attack, they split up into all their constituent parts.
But that's a good... I mean, that's a good thing for... Yeah, but they survive, don't they? Well, okay, yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, can I join the SNP, please? It turns out my granddad was Scottish. We never knew this, but this is now...
I think the SNP is far too right-wing for you. I think the SNP's actual policy platforms are... This is the thing I find fascinating. Is people sort of kind of going, well, the SNP, great left-wingers. And you go, well, actually, they're kind of quite a pragmatic centre-left government, actually.
Well, this is the thing. I've never really felt that that support for a mainstream political party was where massive social change was going to come from. The exercise of a vote at the ballot box is about the least worst option every time. And that's okay. You know, I still go out to vote because I think it's an important part of my civic duty, personally, to go and pick the least worst option and stop things getting worse, you know...
But there's
quicker.
Nothing wrong with that. I mean, Ian Leslie wrote a great blog for us about, I can't remember, it was about Corbyn and Trident, it's about the Nirvana fallacy, about the idea that you constantly compare every politician to, you know, to perfection, essentially, rather than, which always means that everybody lets you down forever. And actually, you'd be much better...
The Nirvana fallacy wasn't Kurt Cobain wasn't killed by the CIA.
Yeah, it was that jet fuel can't melt Corbyn's leadership. But this idea that actually, you know, you look at... And I think that was genuinely why a lot of people voted for Jeremy Corbyn. They looked at all those candidates and they thought, don't fancy any of the other ones, that guy. But had he been up against someone different, then they might not have gone for him. You know, people are very... rational, I guess, about their voting decisions like
that. Yeah, and I'm not going to wait around for... I think there's a tendency on part of the left to say, oh, well, the perfect candidate isn't there, I'm not going to go out to vote. And I do understand that. I think it's people's right to not vote if they want, because, you know, they're dissatisfied with the whole thing and, you know, sod the lot. But I vote not because I'm massively supporting any of the, you know, main parties that are in play right now, but because I think it's a part of the process. I've never believed that politics begins and ends at the ballot box. But I think given that, you've got to be pragmatic.
But also, if you don't vote, some other buggers will.
Exactly.
And they'll probably have terrible opinions, and you've got to counterweight that. Stephen, is there anything that we haven't covered that we should talk about re-Brexit?
Are we really not going to answer the question about the EEA and its impact
Okay.
I've mugged up on this. Okay, you sent me the question. Very keen. I have an opinion on it.
What are the downsides of the EEA, which is this sort of Norway-style membership of the single market, accepting free movement of people? What are the downsides of that deal for UK agriculture?
Well, so the difficulty is if you're in the EEA, you have to accept a lot of rules for trade without setting them. But you crucially don't get that much money back out. So if you are a farmer, you potentially, depending on what things you end up opting in and out of, have a situation in which you have to make sure that your, you know, beef is full of, is not full of antibiotics, which, I mean, obviously, for the avoidance of doubt, I am intensely relaxed about my beef not having antibiotics in it. You know, on the whole, I'm in favour of my meat not having weird things in it. But you don't get money from the Common Agricultural Policy. And, I mean, the interesting thing is whether or not governments... I mean, my assumption is that the government will have to find that missing money from somewhere because people aren't going to start paying £8 for a potato. But the weird thing is that farmers who, if you look at where the votes for Leave came from, do seem to have gone fairly heavily for out, are in a situation where whatever happens, they are going to face some really big difficulties. The advantage of the EA, though, is that they would still be able to take advantage of free movement of labour, which for seasonal work, and you know, particularly in fruit farms, is a big, big, big deal.
Yeah, I think that's something that we kind of need to keep coming back to, because there are a couple of regions of Britain that are heavily dependent on EU money, Cornwall being one of them, North Wales being another one of them. And they're, you know, they have said, we're still going to get that money, right? And that's entirely up for debate at the moment. And as we said before in previous podcasts, Northern Ireland is also, you know, a part of the UK in which, you know, the national security is at risk by the idea of reinstituting a land border. Laurie, have you got any thoughts about agriculture?
Well, yes, I did some reading on this. Okay. And it's... So one of the things about the CAP seems to be that, well, I had no idea, even at the middle of the campaign, that so much of the EU budget went to agricultural subsidies, and that so much of these subsidies were going not to individual farmers, but, you know, giant landowners. Paul Dacre gets 450,000, is it, from just owning basically so, empty tracts of land in Scotland?
Yeah,
and that's the kind of thing that maybe if we were to renegotiate...
I think Osborne's father gets a lot of money for his wind farms as well. Am I right in thinking that? Yeah. It is Osborne's father, yeah.
But,
father,
you know, but wind farms are amazing.
Yeah, wind farms really are really like good. We're pro wind farms.
I don't understand the people who think they're ugly.
They're beautiful.
I just, they're
lovely.
Yeah, and you just look at them and you just believe in a better tomorrow when you see a wind farm. It's just, you know, the human invention and craft and clean energy. And
you can pretend you're
this is probably
Teletubby.
The weirdest thing I've said on the podcast.
No, I know. I don't understand them either. I guess if you live near them and they make a lot of noise. But then when people complain about that, I always think, have you tried living in London? Like, yeah. It's really... people are always yapping outside my window all hours of the night. Laurie, thank you so much for joining us for a special Brexity podcast. Hopefully you'll come back quite soon as the unfolding chaos sucks more of us into its gaping more. But for
check
now,
check and see if I'm on the shadow cabinet yet.
You might be by the time you
hold out. I may not have very much time to be
hold out for DCMS. That's my advice.
Oh my God.
Thanks, Laurie.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, with Stephen Bush. Our producer is India Bork, and our music is Devil with a Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. You can find us on iTunes or at newstatesman.com/podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.